Welcome back to another edition of the Sound Singer podcast. This episode today discusses voice disorders, their impact on singers and voice users, the stigma around having a vocal injury, and how mindfulness can help with healing and help us cope with the stresses of not only voice disorders, but also everyday life. Did you know that mindfulness practices are not one size fits all? We can, in fact, customize mindfulness meditation according to how our brain works. My guest today lets us in on exciting new research and openly shares her struggles with vocal injury. Catherine K. Brown is a singer, adjunct voice instructor, mindfulness teacher, and researcher. She holds a graduate certificate in applied mindfulness, and she offers online meditation courses specifically designed for singers and people with voice disorders. Catherine, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
I'm super thrilled to be chatting with you today about mindfulness because I think it's something that is much needed in the world of voice today. We're living in an age where it's now being taught in schools and universities and in healthcare facilities. And it seems to have a significant impact on our physical and mental well-being. And so your work and research is now making us as voice users realize the importance of integrating mindfulness in our daily lives. Can you chat a little bit about your vocal journey as well as your journey into the world of mindfulness?
Yes, absolutely. So I'm a singer and a voice teacher, but before that I was a voice student. And when I was in high school, I got the flu and I was really sick. It's probably one of the times when I was sickest in my whole life. And my voice just never recovered from that. And, you know, no one really seemed to understand why. I went to an ENT, I went to some speech language pathologists, and I just never really got any answers. So I kept singing, but I really didn't do very well in my undergraduate program. And I was getting a lot of negative feedback from my teachers, and I didn't disagree with them. I was very unhappy with my voice. And so I ended up taking a different path. I finished my degree and then ended up working in arts administration. And during that time, I moved to Philadelphia, which I did not know was kind of a hotbed of like vocal rehabilitation and voice research. And so I met a teacher who worked rehabilitating injured singing voices. And I had never really heard of that. I mean, this was in, you know, my injury happened in the late 90s. And then by this time we were early 2000s and it was kind of a new field still. And so when I heard that she existed, I called her up and I said, listen, I don't even sing anymore, but I want to talk to you about what happened to my voice and if there's any hope for me. And so of course she sent me to a laryngologist and I was diagnosed with vocal full paresis, which is a weakness of the vocal cords. It's basically a nerve injury that we think was caused by the flu when I was sick in high school. And it's typically something that at least once you're a year out from the injury does not improve with time. So there's no cure for it, but you can usually, if it's fairly mild, you can learn to sing around it. And then I was also given a diagnosis of muscle tension dysphonia. So that is a pattern of tension that negatively affects the voice. And I knew I had a lot of tension and I knew I didn't know how to deal with that, how to respond to that, how to fix it. And basically the tension ends up being a way of trying to compensate for the weakness in the voice. So I did really intensive voice therapy. I was in voice therapy for, I don't know, maybe 2 years. And it was really about 4 years before I felt like I really had my voice back. So it was a long process. At some point during that time, I took a mindfulness course. And of course, I was working with my voice teacher on becoming more aware of my patterns of tension, releasing those patterns of tension. And then the mindfulness course was doing the same thing. I mean, it wasn't specifically about tension reduction, but it's about noticing your body. And I started realizing that as a singer, I just had so little awareness of what was going on in my body and so little ability to change what was happening in my body. And my teacher was so skilled at helping me build that. So that was amazing for me. And then I decided I wanted to become a voice teacher. So I did, and started doing that. I got married, I had kids. And during my second pregnancy, I got the flu again. So at that point, it was common to be vaccinated for the flu. When I was in high school, they didn't push vaccines for teens. So of course I was vaccinated, but when you're pregnant, you're immunocompromised. And so I got really sick, and I just thought, well, you know, my voice will get better. My voice was a mess during my first pregnancy too. It just wasn't, you know, my usual voice. And so it was really about a year after giving birth that I realized this isn't going back to normal for me. And so I went back to my doctor, and what they told me the second time was that the paresis, which had previously just affected the left vocal cord, was now affecting both of them. So before, one cord was sluggish to come to the center, and then the other one was right there waiting for it. And then when it becomes bilateral on both sides, they're both sluggish. And so that explained what I was experiencing. You know, I was experiencing what to me just felt like a lack of power in my upper range. And I'd always been a soprano, and it just felt like it took so much effort. What they didn't say is they no longer gave me a diagnosis of muscle tension. I had learned how to work, you know, with my voice in a way that I didn't need to tighten up. But that was, again, kind of my issue. I felt like I almost have to tighten to get up there. And so again, I did voice therapy. It was less helpful the second time, and that's typical when you have a bilateral diagnosis. But what I started to then wonder is, you know, I kind of wondered, what am I going to do with my career? You know, I decided to stop performing. And I started wondering, you know, remembering how much mindfulness had helped me the first time around. And the second time, I felt like the mindfulness was less about noticing muscle tension and more about accepting my voice as it was. Because that was hard. I wasn't happy with the changes, and accepting that I wasn't going to perform. And I will add, I was given the option to do some surgical interventions, but I chose not to do that, partly because, you know, I have little kids and I just didn't think I could do the voice rest and the voice therapy. And that's something I might pursue eventually. But anyway, I decided that I wanted to become a mindfulness teacher, and there's a program just down the street from me that offers that at a university, and you get to do a study as part of the program. So that's exactly what I wanted to do, and I wanted to study voices. So I wasn't sure exactly what I wanted to study. I knew I wanted to see if mindfulness could help either singers or people with voice disorders. And then this whole thing kind of happened during the pandemic. Once I started my graduate school classes in the fall of 2020, and I thought, you know what? This pandemic is going to produce a lot of voice disorders. It's a viral illness that's new, and there are lots of ways it can negatively affect the voice. And so I really decided to focus in on voice disorders. I also felt that a voice disordered population might benefit in a way that was more measurable than in a healthy singing population. Because no one had studied it, I figured it was a great place to start. So I did my study, and the results were really fascinating, and I just published them. They were published in November in the Journal of Voice. So that is my path.
Wow. And thank you for being so open about your personal vocal disorders, because I think there still seems to be a stigma around vocal injury. And so I'm so glad we're having this open discussion around this. Where do you think we're at? Are we living in an age where there's more awareness and less of a stigma? And are singers being more open to sharing this?
I think it depends on a lot of factors. In the classical music world, which is that's kind of where my training was, but I more teach musical theater now, I think there's still a lot of stigma. And honestly, I think anytime a singer is dependent on someone else to hire them, so that's musical theater, classical music, where, you know, a casting director or a director makes a decision about hiring you, I think people keep pretty quiet because they are afraid of stigma. That doesn't mean that people with voice disorders deserve that stigma. Many people with voice disorders are highly, highly functional singers, and a lot of very famous singers have some vocal anomaly that, you know, they're not open about. And that's fine. I do not blame anyone for keeping quiet about a voice disorder, because I think there really is still stigma. I think it's starting to fade. I think there's a lot of education out there that's really wonderful, a lot of speech language pathologists that are doing education about it. And I think we're also moving away from the idea that a voice disorder is caused by poor technique. It's not that that can't happen. It's not that technique plays no role. Often, if there's a voice disorder, there is a sort of a perfect storm of things happening. There's high levels of stress. There's maybe some reflux or some allergy issues that make the vocal cords more prone to injury. And there may be situations where singers are singing more than they should, but they don't feel that they can advocate for themselves. I mean, you see this, I think, a little bit just like in the situations where Adele has been really open about her voice disorders. And, you know, this is a woman who can make millions of dollars, you know, every time she performs. And so there's insane pressure to make those millions for herself, but also for the other people who make money off of her. And so, you know, I think artists need to be able to stand up for themselves. And so part of it is being able to empower singers to stand up for themselves and to have the medical community stand behind them and say, listen, this is really about a medical situation and it's not the singer's fault. And again, you know, we don't see the stigma among athletes. Nobody blames someone for getting injured on the football field or baseball field. And so I think that we need to think of singers more that way, but we don't yet, you know, and singers don't think that way. Singers think that vocal nodules are the main injury, which is not necessarily always the case. They think that it's the end of a career, and they think that it's their fault. And all of those things are, you know, can be true sometimes, but often there's a much bigger picture.
Yeah, it's multifactorial usually. And I'm so glad you brought that up. I think advocating for yourself is a huge takeaway. Is 2024 the year you're going to finally take your voice to that next level? Singing is an art form, but it's also a skill. And just like any other area of expertise, it takes time, patience, practice, and of course, solid training. If you don't know where to start when it comes to training your voice, I'm here to help. My name's Alita, and I've been a voice teacher and industry voice coach for over 15 years. I offer customized private voice lessons online, as well as online singing courses. My course, Mix Evolution, is centered around helping you develop your mixed voice, increase your range, and vocal confidence. Whether you're just starting to develop your vocal technique, or if you're picking your vocal development back up after a long break, Mix Evolution will build and strengthen your voice and give you exercises you can use for life. Just head on over to my website, alitavocalstudio.com, for more info. Over the years, I've been fond of many books on the topic of mindfulness. Authors such as Tara Brach, Eckhart Tolle, Jack Kornfield, and I know that you are very fond of Jon Kabat-Zinn. How do you yourself define mindfulness?
Well, I love Jon Kabat-Zinn's his definition. He's kind of the father of mindfulness in the United States as it's practiced and taught and as it's used in clinical contexts. And so his definition is basically that mindfulness is paying attention in the present moment on purpose and non-judgmentally. And that's the hardest part, I think, is the non-judgmentally. As singers, we can be very self-judging, and so when we go to master a task like mindfulness, we judge ourselves, you know, oh, my mind wandered, I'm doing it wrong. And you know, part of one of the first things I teach people about mindfulness is Your mind wandering is not you doing it wrong. Minds wander, it's what they do. It's a matter of, can you pull yourself back? And that might take 5 minutes. That might take, you know, your mind might be wandering for 15 minutes before you notice it wandered. So it's a learned skill, but it doesn't mean we're doing it wrong if we're, you know, if we're distracted.
So your recent research was published in the Journal of Voice, and I was super fascinated when I saw it. It was entitled The Effects of an 8-Week Mindfulness Course in People with Voice Disorders. Can you tell us a little bit about that study?
Yes. So we had 69 people who participated. 39, I believe, were part of the mindfulness group. So they took the mindfulness classes. And then 30 were part of a control group. So, and the control group, everyone who participated took certain tests, you know, self-report tests, which I'll describe in a moment, and then had the 8-week time period. For some people, they were taking the mindfulness course. For the control group, they were just living their lives, no mindfulness course. And then they took those tests again. And then we compared the control group to the mindfulness group, and we compared the mindfulness group to themselves before and after the intervention. So the things that we measured, we had them do a mindful attention and awareness scale. So that measures their level of mindful awareness before the course. And we measured, we took a perceived stress scale measurement. So that measures how stressful they perceive their lives to be. And then we did the vocal handicap index. So that is a tool typically used by speech language pathologists, and it's divided into three parts. People are reporting on their voice symptoms, and they report on voice function, so how your voice serves you in everyday life. Can people hear you? Do you have to repeat yourself a lot? That sort of thing. Physical symptoms, that might be things like discomfort, clearing your throat a lot, you know, the voice cutting out. And then the emotional response to the voice disorder. And that I felt was really important, because for a lot of people with voice disorders, there is a strong emotional component. They may feel embarrassed by their voice. They may feel that something is lacking in their life because of their voice disorder. So that's also part of the measurement. So we had them take that. And then anyone who self-identified as a singer took the singer's version of the voice handicap index. There's a version that's specifically designed for singers, asking questions about their range and, you know, those sorts of things. So about half the participants were singers. A number of them were very high level singers, and then a lot of them were simply avocational singers. So that's how the study functioned. And as far as the results, it was really fascinating. So when we compared the mindfulness course participants to themselves before and after the 8-week mindfulness course, everything changed in the direction we hypothesized, and that was all statistically significant. So what we saw is their mindfulness scores went up, which we expected. Their stress scores went down, which we expected. Their voice handicap scores went down, and their singing voice handicap scores went down. And that was all statistically significant. The biggest change was to their voice handicap index. We saw smaller changes to their stress scores and the singing handicap index. I can explain more about the singing handicap index in a moment. So that was just comparing the mindfulness group to themselves before and after. We also then compared the mindfulness group to the weightless control group. And so that's a stricter comparison, right? Because you're looking at change over time into separate groups. And so it's just a stronger comparison. So when we did that, the stress scores were not statistically significant, the changes, and the singing voice handicap index changes were not statistically significant. So that means that basically those changes were small enough that it could have just happened naturally without the mindfulness course. And that didn't surprise me for several reasons. One, we just didn't see a big change in stress scores in anyone. It was not a massive change. And I think partly it's because people still have the voice disorder. And although their voice disorder did change, people started with a very high level of disorder. So the Voice Handicap Index is divided into three categories. You have mild, moderate, and severe. And people, the average score kind of rode the line between moderate and severe. Not surprisingly, you know, the people who tend to want to participate in the mindfulness course are people who feel that their conventional treatments have not given them what they needed, right? So these are people with a pretty high level of voice disorder. Some of them, you could really hear the disorder anytime they spoke. Some of them, you know, you couldn't necessarily hear it, but they would say things like, this is a good voice day, I can talk today, but if I talk too much today, I'm not going to have a voice tomorrow. You know, so people who really have to budget their voice use, people who cannot ever talk over background noise, the voice is just too weak for that. Maybe they could sing at one point, they can't anymore. So, you know, pretty severe voice disorders, and they tend to be more severe than what you would see in a singer who's taking singing lessons. A singer who's taking singing lessons probably has a mild voice disorder on that voice handicap index score because they're still able to sing. And so a milder voice disorder can be life-changing in a negative way for a singer. For a speaker who's not a singer or not a professional level singer, it takes a much higher level of voice disorder for them to feel really emotionally impacted by that. So anyway, the people who participated were quite disordered to begin with. They went on average from, you know, just over the line into that severe category to somewhere in that moderate category. And we did interviews afterwards to ask them, you know, what was your experience? And is that change from severe to moderate, is that a significant change for you? And across the board, the answer to, you know, to that question was absolutely life-changing, that it was a huge change vocally for them. But the other thing that we saw was that there were a lot of emotional changes that people experienced. People absolutely loved being in a group with other people with voice disorders because, you know, most people with a voice disorder don't know anyone else who has one. And most singers who have a voice disorder don't talk about it openly. So if they know someone else who has one, they don't know that they have one, right? And so there's not a culture of singers talking about their voice disorders. And especially the people with the really severe voice disorders who had never heard anyone else talk like them. It was extremely emotional. They loved listening to each other. They're like, I'm sorry you had this, but I love hearing that. I love hearing you talk. You know, I love hearing your disorder because it makes people feel less alone. And that was one of the really big takeaways. And it reduces shame around the voice disorder. A lot of people who would try to hide their voice disorder or who would sort of be apologetic about their voice disorder, or who would feel horrible if someone like bullied them about their voice disorder, got to a point where, you know, after the course where they felt like, this is my voice, accept people, other people can accept it because I do too. So that self-acceptance was really, really huge for people. And then the other thing we found too was it really increased people's awareness of how their voice showed up for them physically. We saw this particularly in patients with muscle tension dysphonia. We had a huge range of voice disorders. The most common were spasmodic dysphonia, which is fairly rare, and muscle tension dysphonia. And so, particularly for the muscle tension dysphonia people, and that disorder, by the way, is often paired with other disorders. So we had a lot of people who had two or three or even four voice disorders. And so, you know, often there's some voice disorder that occurs, like with mine, and then the muscle tension disorder comes in as well because it's a compensation, you know, compensating for the weakness or whatever else is going on. So especially for those people, to have the ability to notice when they're starting to get tense, and then to be able to be mindful, check in with the body, release that tension to some extent, that really helped people kind of stop their symptoms before they started. Instead of getting them into this cycle where they're extremely tight and then the voice just isn't functioning at all, they could kind of catch it before it got to that point. And that, again, was really life-changing for people. And so that's an area, that somatic awareness, that awareness of the body, where I feel like anyone can really benefit. A singer, especially someone who's maybe new to singing, new to voice work in general, or just a singer who's not very aware of the body. And that's kind of how I feel I was when I went into voice therapy. I sort of kind of lost touch with my body, and the process of voice therapy was the process of getting back in touch with that. And mindfulness, as much as it, we think of it as being about the mind, it's so much about noticing, you know, how everything shows up for us physically.
I loved the fact that you said that a lot of them highlighted being with other people was a profound influence on their healing, because I think that that just goes to show you having that support or hearing someone else's story normalizes it for you and makes you feel less alone.
Yeah. And it was always interesting in the first class, you know, we would have people would tell their story. So it would just be a brief, I'm so-and-so, I'm from such and such a place. This is my disorder. This is sometimes there's a story of what caused it. You know, surgery can cause certain voice disorders, or, you know, how long they've been living with their disorder, that kind of thing, how it was treated. You know, people would just tell their stories. And I as a teacher would be like, oh gosh, are we going to have time to get to meditation? And then I realized it's not about the meditation in that first class. It's about hearing people's stories. And it's about normalizing living with a voice disorder. And it's about realizing the group dynamic. You see how someone else approaches something differently than you do. And it makes you realize that there are different ways to approach it. You know, and so often emotionally, we get stuck in, this is how I feel about something. And it doesn't occur to us that maybe we could shift that. And I have a great example. There was a woman who was, I believe, in her 80s. She had had spasmodic dysphonia, which is a very stressful voice disorder with a vocal cord spasm. And the treatment for it is Botox. You get Botox to kind of calm down the spasms, but the Botox can have side effects. Your voice can be breathy for a while. For a lot of people, they end up having to get the Botox very frequently in order for it to have an effect. And so it's a very difficult disorder to treat. It's a difficult disorder to live with. And these are the people who you can usually hear it in their voice, you know, very readily. The voice is stopping constantly. And she had had her voice disorder since she was a teenager. I believe she said she was, when she first got Botox, it was being trialed for the first time as a treatment. Now that's been going on for decades, but, you know, because of her age and how early her onset was, she'd been living with it for so long. And she, this woman, went out of her way to hide her disorder from anyone and everyone she knew. She had quit jobs because she was embarrassed by her disorder. There was another woman in the same group who was an executive and in a large company. And she was like, this is my voice. People are going to have to get used to it. Them each seeing each other had such a profound effect on both of them. You know, for the one woman, it was like, well, if she can live with this disorder for these many decades, I can make it through too. And for the other woman, it was, if she can be this confident with the exact same disorder I have, I don't need to hide what I'm going through. And so that group dynamic just, it really changed both of them. And I can, you know, I have so many stories like that. It's pretty amazing.
In your research, you've highlighted that people with voice disorders are often faced with stress, tension, isolation, and grief specifically. How does mindfulness impact our ability to cope with those common issues?
That's a great question. And I think that mindfulness can help us with each one of those. There's evidence that shows that people who show up to a voice disorder clinic have higher levels of stress than the average person. There's even a study that says that their levels of stress are very similar to levels of outpatient cancer patients. So there's been a lot of talk about whether stress is causing a voice disorder or whether it's just stressful to live with the voice disorder. I think there's some of both. Often I think, though, that stress is part of a perfect storm of events that leads to a voice disorder. It's one of those factors. And it is very stressful to have a voice disorder. And this is something that I learned more about teaching this class than I ever knew. Because I had not, you know, I'm not a speech language pathologist, I'm just a singing teacher. And I had not interacted with people with such severe voice disorders. But, you know, for these people, they're having to ration their voice use. They're having to cut back on their social life. The voice disorder can be very variable. And so people don't understand that. They'll say, oh, you're better. Why don't we go out for a drink? And they're like, I can't go to a bar because I'm not going to have a voice tomorrow. Understanding that, you know, variability of the voice disorder, it's very hard for, you know, for family members to get that. So you have to explain that to people, and it's exhausting. And then, you know, sometimes people will make fun of people with voice disorders. They don't necessarily mean to, but it's a chronic illness. And in some cases, it's an invisible illness. And so it comes with all of those stressors, people not quite believing you, people not understanding it, you have to explain it, but then of course you can't talk too much because you have to ration your voice use. And so all of those things are the, you know, what make a voice disorder stressful. You know, mindfulness, I think it can help us reduce the stressors in our lives, and that we can see what stresses us, and we may be able to make changes about what stresses us. But more than that, it changes how we respond to stress, right? So those same stressors are still there, they're still happening, but we can shift how we react to them. So we can notice ourselves getting stressed, and then we can kind of alter how we respond. We can say, okay, instead of getting upset about this, I'm going to notice the upsetness. And as I notice it, I can feel it diminish a little bit. Whereas if we don't notice it, it just happens. We just kind of get on a roll, and we feel really worked up, and then we're in a cycle, right? So we can kind of stop that cycle sooner. So that's kind of how mindfulness can help us with stress. It's also just, mindfulness can also just be very relaxing depending on what meditation we're doing. I will also add though that mindfulness is not always relaxing. Sometimes it's stressful, right? We might meditate and be like, oh, God, I'm just not doing this right, you know, or I'm getting so distracted. That doesn't mean we're not still getting the benefits of mindfulness, but I don't want to present mindfulness as always fun and relaxing, because it can actually feel like work. But again, that noticing our habitual patterns can help us change. So the other thing I wanted to address is grief and loss, especially for people with these more severe voice disorders. They have a sense of losing their social life, losing a job maybe, you know, not being able to participate in life fully. So there's that sense of loss. For singers like myself, there's a sense of loss of identity as a singer, loss of those high notes I used to love singing, loss of that ability to perform. And, you know, there can be a sense of loss around, you know, some of the accolades you get as a singer. For me, the experience of being in a show with colleagues is very different, to not have that. So mindfulness helping us with loss, it is the flip side, I think, of loss and grief is acceptance. And mindfulness is about noticing and accepting what is. And when you've lost a lot, that can feel extremely threatening. For me to say to someone whose life has been turned upside down by a voice disorder, can you start to accept your voice as it is? You know, people will become very defensive. They might start crying. They might say, I don't think I'm ever going to get there. But mindfulness can give them the tools to say, maybe there's something today that I can start to accept. I never present acceptance as something like, you need to get to this point during this course. You know, that's just not the way it works, right? But maybe you can start seeing acceptance as an eventual goal. And again, that focusing on what is, okay, this is my voice. This is my voice today, can be really powerful for people. But it's hard. It is hard. I struggle with it every time I go to sing, you know?
Absolutely. And like you said, mindfulness is a skill. It's kind of like singing. Singing is a skill too. And, yeah. You know, I suppose it's skill acquisition. It's acquired through practice and training. And so what does that specifically look like from a practical perspective? Like, not just for injured singers, but for people in the performing arts in general, how can we bring mindfulness into the busyness of our daily life?
Yes. So that is a great question. One thing I will say is I think practicing mindfulness with a teacher or in a group can be transformative. If you've practiced mindfulness and you're not sure you like it, or you're not sure you're doing it right, find a teacher, take a class, because the same way you would with your singing voice, you know, if you're having trouble there, you're not going to just push through, or you're not going to say, I'll just stop practicing. You're going to find someone who can help you with that. A singing teacher sees all kinds of problems, and they have all kinds of solutions for them. And the same thing is true for a mindfulness teacher. So if you're practicing, you know, practicing with a mindfulness recording or a mindfulness app, that's the equivalent of warming up with somebody's tracks on YouTube, right? They are not customized for you. They are not, you know, tailored to what you need necessarily. They're just what's out there. So that's one thing I would say. But then the other thing we really distinguish between in a mindfulness class is formal mindfulness practice and informal mindfulness practice. So your formal mindfulness practice is when you're sitting down and you're meditating, or you're doing yoga, you're setting time and a time and place aside to do this practice very intentionally. And then mindful awareness is just kind of this informal practice where you're noticing what's around you as you go about your life. So maybe you're hand washing dishes and you're noticing the temperature of the water, and, you know, or maybe you're walking your dog and you're just really kind of taking the time to notice what it feels like to walk, what the air is like, what the trees and flowers are like this in this season of the year. So that's something we can do at any time. And they both feed each other really, really well, right? And one of the things that I tell my students who struggle to sit down and do their formal practice is, okay, maybe you didn't get to it today. So incorporate some more informal practice. When you're walking to the subway or putting your kids to bed, just check in with your body, check in with the space around you. So that's something that we can access at any time. And then I see singing as very much an informal mindfulness practice, where we could make it a more formal practice. But I think that if you're practicing with a singing goal in mind, I would say that that's kind of more of an informal practice, right? We can be mindful while we're singing. We can notice the sensations we're feeling. We can notice the sound. We can check in with our senses. We could also make mindfulness a more formal, or singing rather, a more formal mindfulness practice. But then I think we need to take away a goal. We need to do it for mindfulness's sake rather than for the sake of, I'm doing this because I need to get ready for an audition, or I'm doing this because I want to improve this piece. So I think we can make it a formal practice where we say, I'm just going to notice the sensations, or I'm just going to kind of, you can make it sort of a sound meditation. I'm just going to kind of bathe myself with sound. That's certainly something that we can do. That's not my area of expertise. There are people who do practice in that realm. You know, I am more about mindfulness as its own practice and how that can, you know, help us as singers, and less about making singing a mindfulness practice, but you can work both ways.
What advice would you give to someone who has the mindset of, well, I can't meditate, I just can't? And I loved what you said about trying to implement it even on a walk with your dog. I love to move, so I can see myself trying to implement it in those moments. But I do understand the incredible benefits of carving out 10 minutes of meditation. What's your advice for someone who is sort of on the fence about trying it, or has tried it and hasn't felt like it's been successful for them?
That is a really great question. And I want to start by saying, you know, for certain people, meditation can be really hard. It can be hard for everyone. If you're neurodiverse, if you have ADHD, or if you just have a constant need to move, a sitting meditation may not be the right practice for you, or it may not be the right practice at the beginning. Again, you can make walking a formal meditation. You can start out really slowly. You might want to do it in your house so your neighbors don't think you're crazy, but you know, you can really kind of break down the parts of each step and make that a meditation. So I would say that, you know, meditation and movement are not incompatible. Also, there, you know, we have this idea that, you know, meditation is about sitting still. And I just think that it's not. You can sit. It doesn't mean you have to sit still. You know, I'm on a mission to make meditation a little more ADHD friendly. I have ADHD and I don't have the hyperactive type. So, you know, I don't feel like I have to walk while meditating, but I do feel I do better with shorter chunks. I find it very hard to meditate every single day. And I think we need to get away from this idea that we have to meditate every day for it to be beneficial, because some of us have the executive function challenge that if we meditated every day, other things are going to fall by the wayside and we just can't live life that way.
Thank you for saying that. I really want to highlight what you just said. I feel like there's this pressure, especially the start of the new year. You know, we have all these goals. I'm going to meditate every day. That is not sustainable or attainable for everyone. What would you say would be helpful? Like 3 times a week or twice?
Absolutely. And, you know, I come from the background of the mindfulness-based stress reduction tradition, and that tradition is that you take an 8-week course. During that time, you meditate for 30 to 45 minutes every day. It's a pretty strict protocol. In my courses that I lead, we do kind of a lighter version of that, where we have people meditate for 20 minutes a day. Some people do it every single day. God bless them. Some people, you know, I don't know. We didn't track how much they meditated in my study. And I know some of them didn't do nearly that much. What studies actually show is that, you know, the benefit of the group meditation is very, very strong. And again, this informal meditation, this mindful awareness in everyday life is also really important. So what I tell people is do the practice as much as you can, make it shorter if you have to. If you struggle with sitting, do a 10-minute walking meditation and then do a 10-minute sitting meditation. Sometimes that movement first helps calm your mind if you tend to be a little hyperactive or just, you know, mentally overactive. Or we also, so there's also always yoga incorporated in it. And I worked specifically with a woman who is a wonderful voice teacher who works with people with voice disorders. So the yoga that we do is part of my class, my course, is very much designed for people with voice issues. So there are videos that people have access to as part of the course. Some of them are really short, some of them are longer. So I'll tell people, do the shorter yoga video and then do, you know, the rest of the time sitting with doing a sitting meditation. So usually there is some way for people to practice mindfulness, which is a much bigger umbrella term than meditation, even if they can't sit there and do a sitting meditation. So mindfulness as an umbrella term includes yoga, it includes Tai Chi, Qigong, you know, walking meditation, that kind of thing. So, you know, they may find that yoga is a better way in for them. That is great. Yoga is one of those things that, depending on how it's practiced, can very much be a meditative practice, or it could just be more like exercise. It kind of depends on who you're practicing with. And American yoga can be very like goal-oriented and exercise-based. But if you find someone who's more meditation-based, it can very much be a mindfulness practice. And of course, that's how it was originally invented.
Wow. Those are some great tips. So with the meditations, it's not so much about emptying your mind. I think a lot of people think, well, I need to empty my mind. Is it more about sort of noticing what comes up?
It is. And then we have a choice, right? So, you know, for example, we might notice when we're doing a sitting meditation that we have some pain in our shoulder or our throat, and then we have a choice. We can either just notice it as it is, or we can shift, you know, maybe we can do a little stretch, see if that helps. So it's about noticing and then choosing to respond. So the same thing with a thought. We may see a thought, we may have a thought come by, you know, say I'm meditating and then I'm thinking, oh my gosh, I forgot to text my mom. Well, I can either text her right there, or I can say, you know what, I can come back to that. But again, noticing that thought says, okay, I'm anxious about the things I have to do today, right? So that thought is information. And we can then pull away from that thought and say, all right, noticed it. It'll come back when it needs to. And now I'm going back to my breath or whatever anchor we're choosing to focus on. And the same thing can happen with emotions, right? So we might start to feel grief as we're, you know, meditating or noticing in the body scan, say we're focusing on the neck and we start to feel overwhelmed with grief. Well, we can kind of just ride those feelings like a wave, you know?
Yeah.
Feel that grief. And then often as we feel it, it may start to dissipate a little bit. So again, we're noticing what is and choosing how to engage with it. You could also say, if I tap into grief right now, I'm going to start sobbing and I'm going to lose the next half hour. And I just can't do that. So you could also say, I'm going to focus on my breath again and just not go there.
Yeah.
You know, there's always that choice. So it's about noticing. And then whatever comes up for us, and then choosing how we respond.
And it doesn't take that long. Like you said, you could even do this for 5 to 10 minutes. I mean, everybody has 5 minutes. If they can scroll for 5 minutes, then they've got, not that we're shaming people for scrolling, because I mean, we're all scrollers, yes. But to take 5 minutes out of your day and try to find that anchor, it's probably going to have a lasting impact for the rest of the day and the rest of the week.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing I tell people is if you're having troubles finding a time to meditate, anchor it to another event. So for example, you could do it as you're lying in bed before you go to sleep. You could do it after breakfast. You could do it on your lunch break. You could say, I'm going to do it before I get dressed in the morning. You know, like just anchor it to something else that always happens. Okay, we always brush our teeth, right? I'm assuming we all brush our teeth. So, you know, be like, okay, wait, I'm brushing my teeth. Okay, 5 minutes. I'm going to do my meditation. So there's always ways that we can fit it in, even if it is challenging.
Well, this has been phenomenal. And I so appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedule to be with us. I wanted to ask you one last question. Where can people find you?
So my website is katherinekbrown.com. So that's katherinekbrown. I have two sort of portals, singing and mindfulness. So click on what interests you. The mindfulness portal will take you to my mindfulness courses. Right now, I'm only offering courses for people with voice disorders. Eventually, I would love to offer a mindfulness course just for singers, but that's a little further away. I have a lot of projects going on, and that starts in February. And then I'm also on Instagram, CKB Voice. Pretty much everything I do ends up on Instagram at some point. So you can always follow me there. And then on my website, if you go to katherinekbrown.com/mindfulness, you can sign up for my newsletter. If you are interested in a mindfulness course for singers, you will get informed about that either on Instagram or through email.
And I noticed you have some meditations for sale as well.
Yes, I do. So all of the meditations that we did in my mindfulness course are for sale on the website. They're absolutely appropriate for, healthy singers. One thing I will say, I have a body scan that I absolutely love. I made the body scan that I wanted as a singer. We start from the toes, we go up to the head, and we spend extra time on the throat, the jaw, the tongue, those places where we tend to hold tension. So it's great if you tend to be a tense singer, or if you're just a tired singer, you've been singing a lot, it's great for relaxing those areas. So yes, those are for sale on there as well.
I'll put a link to those in the show notes. Katherine, once again, thank you so much. And I look forward to seeing more from you in terms of your research and all of what you're doing.
Thank you so much, Alita. It's been great to talk to you.